Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this. It is Pilot Episodes, the infrequent flying podcast for you aviation enthusiasts. As always, I am joined by our three trepid... What am I going to call you this week? Pilots. There you go. Just pilots. Boring old pilots. It's going to come up with something fancy, but you can stay with pilots. Godders, how are we?
I'm good. Not been doing any... I did. Have we done the pod last time in...
Yeah, you've flown the chippy.
I mean, that's a downgrade from your usual rockets, but okay.
That's true. And since then, I've flown in a few 787s out to the US and back, but only ever sat down.
Have you been at the Space Center in San Diego?
I did a bit of San Diego last week. I was in LA last week.
How lovely. How the other half of
Colorado before Christmas.
Were you looking at rockets?
I saw a space launch. Let's talk about that later.
Just before we crack on with the aviation stuff, two of my loves combining here. Aviation and, of course, rugby. You're not just an officer in the RAF, not just a high-ranking officer in the RAF. You're also involved with RAF rugby. How was last night?
It was excellent, yeah. So as chairman of Royal Air Force Rugby, the men's first 15 were playing China Rugby Football Club out in China, and it was a really good run out. We lost by 1 point, the last kick of the game. But it was fantastic because
you must have been livid.
How many people do you fire, Godders?
You know who won? Rugby won.
Oh,
Harky.
Does the camera pan to your face, Godders, and you're swearing like a trooper?
They're all out.
You smile gracefully.
I saw the camera, I went, nothing to see. Yes, blight, I immediately fired everyone in the dressing room, and we've got a whole new team for next week. But no, it was really good. And the linkage as well is that in JB's other podcast, Egg Chasers, they were playing it live on their YouTube channel. And one of their podcasters, Tim, was commentating and doing pieces to camera around the pitch. It was good, really good.
Now, we've got a selection of servicemen here. Two of them don't actually follow RAF rugby too closely. How important is the inter-services cut? Because from my point of view, from rugby point of view, it seems like quite a big deal. I mean, I've been keeping tabs on what the Army are doing, the artillery played engineers last night. I've been keeping tabs on the Navy. I've got a feeling, you know, because it's post-COVID, this inter-services cut is going to be pretty, it's going to be pretty spicy.
It's going to be huge. We're playing the Navy at... Ealing Trailfinders in London, in the inter-services, and we're playing the Army at King's Home, Gloucester's ground, out in Gloucester, and then Army versus Navy at Twickenham, which I'm also going to. So it should be exciting actually because we haven't played it in the last 2 years, obviously for COVID reasons.
Now, Air Force did all right. Sorry, boys, I will talk to you guys in a second. Air Force did all right.
You did ask us a question, but God has just jumped in. Yeah. That is a Air Marshal's prerogative.
Go on then, Doug. Did you ever pay attention to any of the inter-services stuff?
Yes, but mostly, and I think I probably speak... to answer your question, in all seriousness, of course it is serious, and the guys that are doing that are playing, I think you and Godders will agree, at a very high level, and it's fantastic to watch. But it's also, I think, for... I would say the majority of the forces, a fantastic social event. So, you know, many's the time that we will get together and, you know, watch the Army-Navy. And The trouble is by the time the social, which starts many hours before, has taken effect, it's questionable about how much of the game you either A, see, or B, remember.
Yeah. Parky, were you ever interested in inter-services?
I mean, if I'm honest, not really. But I mean, I'm not massively into rugby, to be honest, but I do recall from what Dunk said, going to Twickenham and seeing, I think, England, Scotland. And yeah, we definitely had a few before the game. Dunk was right, for once. And, I have vague recollections. I mean, it's a great atmosphere, and it's awesome that it's, you know, I'm sure the standard is, you know, well up there. It must be awesome.
Yeah, you do find out some weird things about the forces following the rugby. So everyone would assume that Royal Marines would be excellent, and they are, except for they're all too fit to have a front row. It seems to be the RAF get a lot of strong lads from weapons loaders, as do the Fleet Air Arm, who provide an awful lot of the Royal Navy team.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You're probably about right.
Yeah,
well, they haven't got the gun running show that they used to do up at the Edinburgh Tattoo. They don't do that anymore, do they?
Do they not? What a shame.
I don't think so. So they could all sort of join the rugby team now.
Well, yeah, but Jill, in that gun running thing, everyone lost fingers. That was the thing.
I was about to say that. You knew when someone was in the Navy gun running team because there were, you know, three fingers on one hand.
Oh, good God.
That was quite a spicy sport, that one.
Yeah,
it was. It was called the field gun race, wasn't it?
Yes, that's what it was called. There's a BBC field documentary about race. It.
Yeah, yeah. And, I think, as you say, there was, I think probably safety's got in the way of it, sadly. What do you say about that, Godders?
Oh, I don't know whether it has. I thought it was still going.
Safety's paramount. Right, stop
safety
that.
People, first
people are losing fingers. We don't want to be doing any of this. It's very unsafe.
So I just
the Air Marshal's done a very, very good risk assessment. And would like to...
I think it's funny that the person who trains all of the young pilots in the Royal Air Force is the one going, self and safety gone mad. I'm writing to the Daily Mail. They don't do exactly. Gun running anymore and drop wheels on their heads.
Anyway, Duncan, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
What have you been up to?
Well, you know, so at work, so work-wise, I've been very involved in, and I think I've mentioned it before, the Prefect Basic Flying Training, which is we're trying to get as many of our young pilot trainees through to the front line as soon as possible. We've started as well as doing training on Texan at RAF Valley, we've started doing the same training but on the Prefect, therefore saving time and then getting those guys to the front line a little bit quicker, so boosting numbers to the front line. That's the aim of the game. So I've been sort of very immersed in that in the last few days. We've got a new course starting in a few weeks' time, so it's getting ready for that, and in doing so, going and flying some of the sorties we do that for our little Prefect, which is a relatively basic aeroplane, trying to do relatively advanced stuff with it is A, quite good fun, and it's B, it's quite challenging. So I've been often done a sortie doing that, which is time on target, low-level stuff, which is it's good fun. It's great.
The Prefect is pre-Texan, is it not?
Yeah, it's it is pre-Texan if we were in the traditional system. However, because people are trying to think outside the box, and because of the performance of the Prefect, which is not quite as good as the Texan, but it's nearly there. They're saying, right, why can't we do basic flying training, which they do on the Texan? Why don't we do that on the Prefect? So it's taking the Prefect flying to a different level and trying to give the trainees enough, because of the lack of both performance in relation to the Texan, but also of the technicality of the aeroplane, and the sort of, it's not really a particularly military aeroplane in that, you know, it's got no ejection seats, it's not a tandem, it doesn't feel like a military aeroplane as such. Trying to put a basic flying training course together, which produces the correct product at the end of it, is a challenge.
That's a quick question about the Texan. Very quickly. How closely related or how alike are your Texans next to the rather sexy ones that we see occasionally banded around, which are painted grey and got bombs hanging off them, and Do you know the ones which they market as the low-cost replacement for ground attack aircraft? How closely linked are they? Are they the same aircraft or are they completely different?
Yes, they are. So there's a few differences. So I've flown both. The one that you're talking about is called the Wolverine.
That's it.
And the difference is, well, it's got the same engine in it. The engine in the Texan that we have is a flat rated, and it's effectively the engine can produce 1600 horsepower, but what they do is they restrict it to 1200 at sea level, such that as it climbs they use that extra power, so it's got the same performance all the way up to, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but maybe 15,000 feet, which means you don't lose that performance as you climb, and that tries to give it, they're trying to get jet-like performance from it, but with the effectively the cost of a turboprop, which is much cheaper to run.
That's quite clever.
So you then the Wolverine itself, then it just has all of that 1600 straight away. It's still, when you put weapons on it, it's relatively underpowered when you compare it to a jet aircraft, but the other thing it's got, which the Texan that we have doesn't have, is it has a 1553 data bus, which is effectively the weapon system that allows it to talk intelligently to those weapons to make sure that the targeting systems can work properly, and that the Texan that we have for training doesn't have that. It just has a simulation of it.
That sounds pretty cool. I like that. Parky, how are we? Are you flying it? Are you out of your winter hibernation?
Yeah, just beginning to come out of hibernation. You know, I'm sort of dusting down the straw. I think hopefully by the end of this month, I'll be getting airborne in a spit, which will be lovely. But I get my sort of flying fix mainly every Friday when my number two boy, James, who was on a previous podcast.
Yes.
He's now at Shawbury. So he's on the helicopter and he's utterly loving it. He's absolutely, and just hearing his his energy and just the fun he's having, it's hard work, but it seems a really cool course those boys are doing. Far better instructors, especially the last guy he flew with at Cranwell. But he's really loving it and enjoying the helicopter stuff. So it's just great to kind of, I mean, I know you boys, because of the Harrier, you did a little sort of itty bitty course at Shawbury yourselves. Was that on the Gazelle, I guess, back in the day?
Yeah.
But it just seems just to be a great, real hands-on thing that you're flying. But he's getting it, he's sort of hovering around and, landing the thing. And that must be quite a cool instructor next to him. But no, he's having a blast.
We went on a visit to Shawbury in my last job, actually, to go up and see how they did their training and everything. It was flipping brilliant. And you're right, Parky, they're Airbus helicopters that they fly up there. There's two different types.
It's called the Juno, I think. But you're right, it's the same as a police or an air ambulance, Eurocopter kind of thing.
Yeah, so we went in the simulator and, because I'd done the Gazelle time, I thought, wow, this would be easy. Actually, it was a little bit harder than I remembered. But what was funny was...
Is that like the chipmunk?
Yeah, exactly. So I was sat next to the rear admiral that I worked for, and he had thousands of hours on helicopters. He'd flown Sea King, I think, for most of his time. And when he... So I'm sat next to him and he comes in and tries to land on the ship and completely smashes into the side of it. And I went, well, I'll give it a go. I took off from the ship, flew it around the place. And actually, I was coming alongside this. So he smashed into the side of a carrier and I came alongside this. It must have been a Type 23 with this tiny little landing deck at the back. And it was coming in really nicely. And I was cracking it until he leaned over and pushed the stick when I was about 5 feet from landing and toppled over the side. And I just think he couldn't cope with the fact that I was going to land it.
Two things. A, it was the Queen Elizabeth, not a Type 23 destroyer.
Yeah.
So the deck was bigger than 8 football pitches.
Yeah, that was the one he landed on or crashed into.
Yeah.
My one was a Type
And secondly, 23. No one touched the stick, did they? That's in your mind. He touched the stick and then I crashed.
Every crash I've ever had, it was someone else's fault.
Even when you were on your own.
Yeah, exactly. It was the wind. the wrong size runway.
Yeah,
all these sorts of things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Just on the
but the simulator, everything that they had there was brilliant. I'm not surprised James is really enjoying it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they it's a big setup there. I mean, a lot of aircraft. They're sending pictures, and there's just dozens of helicopters all sort of floating around, you know, and it's a massive wave. But, you know, I think it's just serviceable and, you know, fingers crossed it'll finish November. You know, it seems to be on time and really good. You know,
So it's quite a long old course then?
Yeah, it's nearly a year. Yeah, I think it's sort of split into two bits, sort of more, I guess, you know, learning to fly the helicopter and then operating thing a little bit more tactically. But, you know, he's coming up to engine out landings in the helicopter, which I imagine is quite interesting. Did you do that stuff when you did the Harrier thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Auto rotation. Yeah, you did do it.
Yeah,
a little...
yeah that was one of the best in the Harrier, though, was it? It's quite pointless in a way.
No, I definitely auto rotated in the Harrier every now and again. Normally, when I tried to do a slow loop or something. But, hey, here's a quick question. So, as a dad, and knowing what you know about flying, do you ever worry about that?
No, you know, you just don't do. I don't know why.
Well, particularly when he was taught by the best, Parky.
I'm worried about that trip quite a lot, to be honest. For the listener who doesn't realise, the last trip that my lad did at Cranwell, which was bizarrely the last ever 57 Squadron Army sortie.
Yeah.
Because they've stopped doing it, was my lad and Duncan Mason.
Wow. Yeah.
Which is just bizarre.
Well, I'm hoping to go and see him soon because we've just been sort of planning, right, where are we going to land away for these courses? You know, part of the course is landing away and doing trips to different places. And Shawbury's up there, so I'm hoping to see James relatively soon.
That'd be great.
James is going to Apache, is that right? Or could he be posted any helicopter?
Well, yeah, it's mainly Apache. The Army are just swapping. They're going to an E model, which is the latest equivalent to the Army one. So some of the boys at the moment are doing their conversion to Apache instead of Middle Wallop. They're doing it in Vegas, which must be awesome. And there's a few boys that are even going to do their first tours out there.
Oh, my
word. It's obviously when they then bring these newer models back, James will then be, fingers crossed, going, I think he wants Apache. They have got, is it the Wildcat?
Wildcat's cool.
Those as well, but it's, I think the Army Air Corps is, you know, 90% Apache is the sort of the main type they got.
I've got to say,
where would they be doing it in Vegas?
Ooh, I'll find out.
I can't think of any Army airfields out there.
Yeah, I'll Google that whilst we carry on.
I think they're being dummied into it, and it's in Alaska somewhere. Or
come
out to Vegas,
North Dakota.
Yeah, brilliant. Now, just on the rotary wing stuff, I can see why it'd be excited. I was reading an article the other day, an interview, I should say, with Nimrod Cruise, and I thought it was really interesting because they pointed out that for a lot of pilots, a lot of serving Air Force staff, you don't really deploy or you don't see that much active service. Whereas they were saying that they did active missions pretty much every day. You know, it never stopped. I think it's probably the same for the rotary wing boys too. Because particularly if you're in search and rescue and that kind of thing, you're pretty much always doing real life missions day in, day out.
Yeah, from my perspective, when I left Lossiemouth, they were just putting in the P-8 hangars. P-8 is up there now. I think they've got, what is it, 9 aircraft now? I think those guys are pretty busy. Doing operational missions on a fairly regular basis. And certainly back in the Nimrod day, you speak to any of the guys who lived up there, and actually there's Nimrod guy, ex-Nimrod guy works with me at the moment. You're right. And when they were hunting those submarines, it did sound like it's proper cat and mouse mission, putting the sonar boys in the right area, you know, listening out for them, understanding whether, you know, they were picking up something on one of them, whether they had to move their what they were doing. So I think you're right. And search and rescue as well, completely take my hat off to those guys in terms of the sort of the weather that they fly in, the way they get out and rescue as many people as they can. But having done a little bit of hovering in and around a ship on a simulator badly, as I just said, you know, how they do that at night on a pitching deck with masts.
Yeah.
And all of those sorts of things. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Legends.
Now, I'm just going to nip in there because actually there's a question that we got that's pertinent to this.
Go on.
Well, first of all, there's a little sort of for those that are listening. I was going to say for the first time or on recent pods, but who am I kidding? We've only got two listeners. So if either of you can't remember the pod that we did live from Farnborough, we spoke about the Nimrod and looking into that sub hunting. There was a really fascinating bit in that. So if you're looking for past episodes to listen again to, then that's perhaps for you. But there's a question.
That was Stu, wasn't it?
Stu, yeah.
Stu Butler.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Stu Butler. And talking about that, which was brilliant. But you've mentioned search and rescue there, and we've got a question. Now, Goddard has handed the Twitter questionosphere to me this evening because he's had a small technical failure. I won't do nearly as good a job, but I'll do my very best. So Ralph, at Ralph-E-S, says, search and rescue, exclamation mark. When I was little, we lived near RAF Wattisham, and my hero was the man looking out the side of the yellow Sea King as it went over. He waved back occasionally. I don't think any of the guys ended up in one, but any tales or dits would be interesting. Thanks. Now, you know, you're right, God, as you've just spoken about search and rescue and an amazing job that they did. And I think, you know, probably I'm right in saying that everyone was, you know, so disappointed that the RAF search and rescue didn't continue. Those yellow helicopters were, well, you know, a saviour for many, many people. And I think it's a shame that it got civilianised. But hey, them's the times. But anyone got any tales of search and rescue?
Well, I'm going to ask Parky about Wattisham, actually, because were you based at Wattisham, Parky?
No, on the S4, I was Lucas and Wildenrath, but I went to my last Phantom trip, I landed at Wattisham, so, you know, but, you know.
No, I was just going to wondering what the sort of relationship with the guys at the place was, but my overriding memory of search and rescue helicopters was, A, being massively relieved when they turned up, because it's once a year, isn't it? You do a dinghy drill.
Yeah.
So I managed to get in a cycle when it was the coldest part of the year. So you'd be turfed into the sea in January somewhere. Try and bounce off the water because your hands turned into boxing gloves as soon as you were in. But you'd be bailing out your dinghy. The waves are up and down because it was never that nice. And then you'd hear the little chopper sound in the distance and these things would turn up and you'd be like, yes, here we go. But then, depending on when you got thrown out of the boat, they'd go to the upwind person first. And if you were downwind, you knew you had about another 20 minutes or half an hour. They pick people up and then deposit them back on the ship. But my overriding memory is of fighty winchmen at the end of the winch. Winchmen, are they the ones at the end of the winch? Or are they the ones operating the winch? You know what I mean? Because they would come
the winchier or the
into the water. They're doing the you know, hand up the winch E, and they'd be doing hand up and down, and then they come in. You know, you've got the sea starts boiling around you with the downdraft of the helicopter. Your raft's moving around a bit, and they'd come in waist deep. You'd see them stop the hand, and the guy on the operating the winch would stop the winch at that point. And then the helicopter would move them in. So sometimes they'd come in at, you know, reasonable speed, depending on how fast or how slowly the helicopter was going. And you could see this bloke dressed in all of his gear, and it was normally a bloke, with a big helmet on. And in order to grab hold of you, would do this massive left hook or a right hook around the dinghy and then grab it. And then there was this massive kerfuffle and a scuffle whilst he tried to get the right way up. You presented him with what they were called lifting beckets, so these bits on the life jacket that you would hand to them. They would hook on to that bit, and then laterally they'd put a little strop around your underneath your arms and a strop around your legs as well, give them the up, and then you go on up. But it was always a little bit fighty at that bit in the water, I remember. Or maybe it was just me.
No, you're right. And what's great is the detail that you remember there, which is brilliant. But you're right. It was fantastic to actually then end up getting winched out and up to the helicopter. And again, I don't think it happens very much anymore. Parky, have you got any tales of being rescued from anywhere?
No, I mean, exactly as Goddard says, you just floated in your dinghy. And it was like sort of little chirpy chickens or birds, wasn't it? Sort of me, pick me, but hoping that you'd be winched out first. And I can remember just that sort of, as you're getting winched up, the sort of the massive, the smell of the jet engine, it was just great. It was a very cool bit.
Yeah, you brought it back. Do you remember the warmth of the jet engine as well as you were being winched up? Was always one of those, I'm almost on the boat having a bowl of soup or whatever they gave you at
exactly,
the end.
Exactly, yeah. But we had search and rescue at Lucas when I was first joined the F4. And, I think... Definitely, massive mutual respect for those boys. You know, I think we were doing such a different thing, the fast jet to the Hilo world. And, we definitely sort of, they were lots of, 24-hour, it was a bit like just being on quick readiness alert on the jets. You know, they were permanently, doing wacky hours and stuff. And, they definitely put some long shifts in, those boys. But they were cool. They were great. And, was there an outfit out in Cyprus that you... Yeah, there was, wasn't there, that we used to do dinghy drills on the Reds out there, Dunk?
Hoot and roll with 84.
That's it, yeah.
84 squadron.
Yeah, definitely sort of got on well with those guys.
Parky, cool. Is it quick readiness alert or quick reaction alert?
Well, I guess it's... it probably is quick reaction, isn't it?
It probably is, it is.
Around about 30 years, and I'm wondering...
I only did it for 30 years, but we just call it QRA, you know.
Quaking reaction alert.
So Q is actually what we called it.
So it sounds like I might be the only man here...
Guys are busy as well.
Sounds like I might be the only man here that have actually used the services of the rescue helicopter in real life.
Yeah,
sounds like you guys all drilled it. So, I'm from Llandudno. So first things first, huge thank you to those guys because they're absolutely integral to almost any seaside town where you get a bunch of people from inland who think that they can swim or want to go fishing out by oil rigs on lilos and all sorts of things. So, you always see those guys.
But was that you?
Mine's more embarrassing, actually. We went on a school expedition across Scotland, kayaking, and we had these, metal poles, because part of the paddle was on some fairly shallow rivers, so you use the poles instead of paddles, so you can pole along. And you also use these poles to strap your canoes together, make a rudimentary sail, and away you go. So two canoes to each sort of rig, if you like. So we get onto Loch Ness. I don't know if you've ever been on Loch Ness, but it's bloody massive. It is absolutely enormous. And we start going along, and the weather turns. Now, I would say that these waves were something like 4 foot, which doesn't sound very big, but when you sat down, they're bloody huge. And one of the boys panicked, and they turned their kayak sideways. When you turn your canoe sideways, starts taking on water, and then all these poles started bending, and one of the flotation things disappeared, and then half of the canoe is now starting to sink, and the other half is kind of keeping up. So we managed to paddle to the side, and thankfully, the boys managed to paddle to the side, but unbeknown to us in the meantime, someone else who was watching phoned the helicopter. So they flew out, they hovered over us, we had search and rescue boats around us and all sorts. It was great.
Well, did you get picked up by them? Did they winch
you? No. So they would have... I think the helicopter came out as a precaution. They would have picked us up on the boat, but we managed to get to the shore anyhow. But the bloody... Loch Ness is huge. It's absolutely enormous.
Well, it's about 60
miles. It is massive.
Yeah.
About 60
miles. But it's wide, though. It's over a mile wide, isn't it?
More than that.
Isn't it the largest body of fresh water in the UK?
It is. Yeah. It most certainly is.
Yeah. But I'm afraid I trump you, JP, because I did get picked up for real.
For real?
For real. Well, we were on...
Hang on. Did you run out of energy riding your bike?
No. Hyperglycemic.
Yeah.
Get the helicopter out.
That would have been fighty. That would have been a massive windmilling dunk.
No, it was
basically grabbing the winchman and
No, it was an underslung load of snacks that they brought out for me.
It's dropped off.
No, it was... we were doing some hill walking in Snowdonia, and one of the girls with us went over and broke her ankle, just went over on her ankle. We were up on one of the ridges, I can't remember which one, and so it was a beautiful day, but the yellow Wessex pitched up and hovered above us, and I guess they were on a quiet day, because the winchman came down, they winched the girl up with the ankle, and he said, "Where are you guys all going?" I said, "Well, you know, we're going to go and camp at this point over here." Showed him on the map. He said, "Do you want a lift?" He was like, "Oh yeah, we dig a lift." So we all got winched up into the helicopter, and they then took us down and dropped us off at the edge of this mountain lake in the middle of nowhere.
So I've been in the Wessex. I've never been in the Sea King. They used to park the Wessex on the promenade in Llandudno every Sunday.
Yeah.
This was cool.
A Wessex as well. This was a Wessex. So it was...
I think I've used it before, but there was a brilliant phrase, because I did about 100 hours in the Wessex in the left-hand seat when I was holding, waiting to go to... after Cranwell, before basic flying training. And it was down at Benson. They used to strip all the Wessex down and put them back together again. And I was holding with the unit test pilot there. Trevor Wood, he had 5,000 hours Wessex.
That's a lot.
And I heard this awesome phrase where one of the pilots said, "Hovering a Wessex is like trying to hover a council house through the upstairs bathroom window."
What a great machine, though, that is.
Which I thought was brilliant. But it was a great...
My Wessex story...
Wessex loved flying the Wessex.
I can remember a trip in the Wessex. We were in Cyprus doing F4 gunnery out there. And the boss and a few of us, he went, "Boys, we've got an offer." And it was the 84 squadron, did you say, Dunk?
Helicopter with 84.
But those boys took us, and we landed the Wessex on the USS Saratoga. Ooh. And then just watched, probably for about 4 hours, the Tomcats launching and going into the trap, which was utterly brilliant, and then flew back to Akrotiri.
Wow, that's amazing.
I've got a picture somewhere, and it's kind of cool. All these Tomcats, and at the end of this sort of line, there's this funny little Wessex, which was that. You could see the Americans going, "That's a weird looking helicopter."
They would never design that helicopter, would they? Yeah. No, that looks too weird. It doesn't look cool enough.
You went on the Saratoga. How long ago was that?
1987, 88, something like that.
Christ. So that you must have got that right before it retired. Because that was a class of aircraft carrier just before the Nimitz. Is that a Forrest? I don't know what it is. Maybe I don't know. But it's one before the Nimitz. That's an old ship.
It was
JB, how old were you in 88?
88, I was 4.
Jesus. Well, I don't think
there's
we should
Grandpa.
Go
there. And there's Grandpa on his aircraft carrier in Cyprus.
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if that was a Second World War machine.
Khaki or the aircraft carrier?
I'm going to carry on with the questions, because there's a few here. Now, normally we don't need to encourage Godders to talk. But in this particular case, we've had a couple of requests. Clearly, he hasn't been talking enough. And so we've definitely got at least two. One from Matthew Key has asked for an intro to Godders' new day job would be good. And also Jim at Weed Have Hedgehog says, update on Godders' junior rugby career, how he's seen the light and left the stripy fiends from Leicester for the USA. And the uniform for Space Command. So there's a bit of rugby. A bit of what's going on with Godders, both senior and junior. And I think probably there's been a few questions about the uniform as well, which probably we can all comment on, because it's not just Space Command, I think.
Oh, look at that. Well, that's interesting. I'll keep it short. So Godders Junior is currently seeing if he's going to get a contract somewhere. He was with the Houston Sabres, got rid of all the players when they came bottom of the league last year in America. Because they got rid of... all of the other teams were full. So he's still awaiting a contract, but actually now looking to go to University next year. In my day job is flipping brilliant. So UK Space Command, the reason we came along, I always use the aircraft carrier analogy, actually, having just talked about aircraft carriers. You wouldn't put an aircraft carrier in an operational environment without firstly understanding that environment and secondly being able to protect and defend that aircraft carrier. And so it's the same in space. Space has become a lot more contested and congested. The congested stats are kind of cool. In the year 2000, there were around about 750 active satellites. There'd been a lot more launched since 1957 when Sputnik went up. But the active ones, by the year 2010, there were 1,000. So in 10 years, it had gone up 250. In 2020, so over double the amount that were already up there were launched. By July last year, 1,500 had been launched. And by the end of the year, over 3,000 had been launched as well. So you see exponential in terms of how much stuff is up there. So it's busy. You need to understand what's going on. And then contested, anyone see in the newspapers about Russia shooting a missile in November last year and destroying one of their satellites, creating a huge debris field? And if you've ever seen the film Gravity, which all of this stuff could happen, it talks about the Kessler effect, which is debris creating debris as it hits more stuff. That sort of thing can happen. So yeah, we're all about looking out for these things, looking out and understanding what's going on up there. We've got our own, at the moment, huge satellite communication satellites, the Skynet satellites. And sometimes it gets a little spicy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So they've given us a bunch of money to go and buy some new capability in terms of looking into space, understanding space, some space control type stuff, and some future satellite communications. And so whenever it was, 31st of March last year, there were 6 of us. Right now, we've got about 470 of us. And yeah, we're on the build. So we reach our initial operating capability by in April this year. So it's really exciting. It's fantastic. I get to speak to US Space Force, the Australians, French, Germans, Canadians, New Zealanders, an absolute ton of stuff through NATO. It is fascinating. I love it.
So my first question is, who on earth thought it was a good idea to call satellite Skynet after the Terminator? I mean, I would have thought that'd be the one name that you'd avoid.
Skynet came, so the satellite Skynet was there first before the Terminator movies came out.
No, was it really?
Yep.
There we go. I take it all back then.
Now, so the question is, flipping Terminator movies, why would they possibly have named it that?
Exactly. What did they know? The other thing
is, they know? It's classified. I can't tell you.
What is the major concern for Space Force now? Is it things like space debris? That sounds very trivial, but it does sound like it is an increasing problem. And how are you going to sort that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, definitely. Funnily enough, our vision is to make space safe, secure, and sustainable for all generations. And the sustainable bit is of making sure that Russia and people like that shooting satellites, exploding them, and creating debris. So the Foreign Commonwealth Development Office, have just got a motion tabled at the UN for a discussion and various committees on international rules in space, so that we can get to a point where people are acting responsibly in space. Because when you look at what Elon Musk, what Jeff Bezos are doing, they're trying to get to the moon again, trying to get to the Mars. And almost every single part of our daily lives, we're using some sort of space-based service, normally a GPS-type service. A signal of that is traffic lights, banking, emergency services, all of these sorts of different sorts of things. And so, you know, ensuring that space does stay accessible for everyone is a huge deal. So for us in the UK, we're working really closely with the UK Space Agency, the civilian side of it. We're doing the military side and working closely together to make sure it stays that way.
It does sound fascinating, Goddess. It's brilliant. I guess someone's asked the Russians the question, why have you done that then? Because it does seem, you know, I know it's very naive sort of sounding question. It does sound quite irresponsible. We're just going to fire a missile up. I guess that is that, you know, positioning and postulating?
Yeah, I think it's all, I think it's a little element of, I think it's exactly that, Dunk. You know, it's hey, look, we've got this capability, you know, as they do with an awful lot of different things. You see North Korea testing ballistic missiles and those sorts of things at the moment. It's a show of capability so that you are aware of these things. And you know, so ultimately, our job is to keep everything safe up there anyway, and it is all about diplomacy before you even get into into any shooting.
I bet you it is. I bet you can't tell us, well, I was going to say the half of it, but I imagine 99% of it. It must be really interesting.
Super fascinating. Well, it's brilliant. It genuinely is.
Will we ever get a sovereign launch capability over here?
Yeah, definitely. So this year, actually, we're looking at there's Shetland, Outer Hebs, Sutherland in Scotland, and what is Spaceport Cornwall. I've been down to the team down there. Melissa Thorpe is, you know, she was brilliant showing us around. The one in Cornwall, and we've got an RAF pilot flying with Virgin Orbit. So Virgin Orbit is they fly Cosmic Girl, it's 747 Virgin 7 rocket underneath the right-hand wing. And that rocket is a satellite delivery system. So that will take off, fly to wherever the launch position is, basically go into a fire launcher one off. That goes into the satellite into the areas that they're supposed to be. And then Cosmic Girl comes back, lands, jobs are good. I think he's flipping brilliant.
Yeah, that's amazeballs.
Tell me about the economics of this, right? So we're launching rockets, presumably, to get satellites in space from Cornwall or where else it may be, Shetlands. How economical is that compared to just paying SpaceX to do it?
Well, that's exactly the point. You know, Virgin Orbit have already proven they can do it in various places around the world. I mean, that's the advantage of being able to take your launch system with you. And so it's not entirely reliant on customers over here. And for the vertical launch, for the guys doing it by rockets, very much like SpaceX up and around the Scotland area, you know, they've got a business plan, they've got investors, and ultimately it is not just British satellites that they'll be launching. If they can get their price points down exactly as you say, then they'll be over the world. So, you know, it's a standard commercial market. You know, I think it's brilliant.
Are the Virgin rockets reusable?
Yeah, go on.
Are the Virgin rockets reusable?
No, not Launcher One. There's a couple of companies looking at reusable at the moment. We met a company, I'm trying to remember the name, out in Florida, actually, where they're 3D printing their rocket.
Wow.
Will be reusable as well. But SpaceX have led the way. And actually, we talk about aviation books. There's a couple of brilliant books out there. One that is a really, really good read for anyone is called Space Barons. And that is about Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, is Paul Allen before then, Richard Branson took over the Virgin Galactic side of things. Another one's called Liftoff, which is a lot more detail on Elon Musk and how they got there. And it wasn't easy. You know, he formed SpaceX in 2002, I think it was. A lot of failures first before they actually got there. And you talk about being economical. They were minutes away, essentially, days away from pulling the plug on it.
Now, what are the more outlandish ideas out there for space. So I'll give an example of one which I heard the other day, which I really like, which is basically keeping stores up in space, say a bunch of Humvees or a bunch of a bunch of ammunition or something, and you literally have the option to space drop these things wherever you want. As long as you can get them up there, getting them down is relatively easy. What are the more outlandish things which people are talking about?
Honestly, if you can think of it, someone else has thought of it and is trying to operationalize it in space. We went to see an awesome company, this Cardiff-based company, Spaceforge, and they are about manufacturing in space, ultimately manufacturing silicon-based chips, you know, that sort of stuff. In a because zero G, zero temperature, you know, you get a much more efficient chip or whatever at the end of it. But looking at the tech they are then using, and you can imagine in a lockup in Cardiff, to then re-enter this very, you know, small, I'd say, you know, smaller than a washing machine sized satellite, and then bring it back to Earth and catch the thing without breaking the payload and everything is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, and isn't there
there's other things out there? Yeah.
Is there things to do with making chips in a vacuum? Isn't that quite important for some reason?
Yeah, so it's vacuum, gravity and temperature. So,
yes.
You know, almost perfect in all of those. Not quite, but the utterly brilliant. These guys who just decide down the pub one day, you're going to start a space company doing that. There's another really interesting thing I was reading about the other day, which was essentially a solar energy station that you put into orbit. And this sucks up the sun's rays, converts them into essentially a laser that they then fire down to a power station on Earth. And the energy within that laser is the power. So
we could do
it's
with
not a terrestrial. Yeah,
now,
it's not a terrestrial
prices are going
power station.
Up.
Now, that sounds like the most innocent way to describe a destructive space laser. Yeah, don't worry about that thing, you know, going around the globe, which fires lasers into the power station. We'll never use that on your country.
That thing that... It's a...
Yeah, that's very
what?
Sneaky.
Why has it got a skull and crossbones?
I know it looks like a death ray.
It looks like a death ray, but it's absolutely not a death ray. It's absolutely not one of them.
Are we the baddies?
Wow.
Now, hey, listen.
I think funny you should say that, JB. I think it was a Chinese patent, that particular one.
I can only imagine it was.
I was going to ask, Godders, just the... I know you said, you know, in terms of the number of satellites up there, you know, the 1,500, you know, launched. When did you say the 1,500 launched in the last...
Yeah, so 3,000 last year. So 1,500 in 2020,
yeah.
Then 3,000 last year. So it's exponential at the moment, primarily because of two companies. OneWeb, which is a British company that has in low Earth orbit, so around about 1,000 kilometres above us, have got 390 at the moment, going up to 650 satellites, which provide broadband to rural areas. And Elon Musk has got another company called Starlink, and they've currently got in the order of 2,000 satellites up there.
Wow!
Doing exactly the same thing. So
42 went up today alone.
Yeah, you're right. There was a Falcon 9 launch today out of Cape Canaveral, which I saw one when we were out there just before Christmas, which was amazing actually, because you could see that at night, you could see it reaching. You know, one of the burns into orbit, and you can just see the booster separate as it comes away. And you've all seen on YouTube just how amazing it is when those boosters then go and land on the drone ships that they have, and then they bring them back in. When we saw that Falcon 9 on the pad, the booster side of it was just a good bit of patina, as you would say, Parco, with the on the side of this rocket, because this particular one I think had been used 5 times. So just amazing. That's how they brought the launch down. I think it was something like $20,000 a kilo to get into space for years. But then in the last few years, it's down to $2,000 a kilo. And they reckon the next 5 years, it'll be down to $200 a kilo.
That's incredible,
wow.
Isn't it?
Hey, so with all of those satellites going up there, and I know, you know, space is pretty vast. I get that. But given that are we... Is there a danger of saturation? And, you know, we've got all these spaceports talking about, you know, launching all these different satellites for different reasons. How many do we need up there and for what? And, you know, is it going to keep exponentially expanding, or is it going to, you know, settle at, right, well, we only need 1,500 a year now. And where are those 1,500 a year going to go? I guess, you know, there's different altitudes, different orbits, etc. How is that all coordinated? Because it must logistically become quite tricky.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And the, you know, certainly, so another orbit, geostationary orbit, so that's the one 36,000 kilometres away that all of the, so your Sky TV, there's an Astra satellite sat out there doing your Sky TV, and they are orbiting at the same speed that the Earth is rotating. And so the you know, these ones that are 36,000 kilometers away, actually there are,
yes I don't know again.
Should we move on to the next question?
So have we not recorded any of this?
I did think it sounded a bit tinny today, question done, because there is a lot of stuff going up there, and space at the moment is governed by the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. And I don't think they thought of a huge amount of this. So in America, it's the FCC that governs, I think it's the FCC, that governs what satellites are going up. But geostationary Earth orbit, 36,000 kilometres away, which all the communication satellites are, there's a United Nations subcommittee that governs who goes where. So there are orbital slots that you have to bid for and then get. And once you've got the slot, you know, some of those satellites have been up there 20 plus years. And so that is a biggie in terms of how people, especially, so if you take China at the moment, so China's late to the space race, if you like, but are doing a flipping good job right now in terms of what they're putting up. Last year, they launched more, 52 launches compared to America's 49. And that's the first time America has ever been overmatched in terms of space launches. And so an awful lot of commercial satellites that sit over the top of China. Now, China obviously want to get in on the game as well. So how that works and how that's governed is really, really important. And I mentioned the movie Gravity earlier. That is a big deal, the Kessler effect, which is that knock-on effect of debris essentially creating a huge colander of debris around the Earth. The effects of that could get worse, or would get worse, the more satellites you put in orbit. So a lot of the manufacturers, a lot of the operators now do an awful lot of mathematical modeling just to understand that the ones that they put up aren't going to be the problem. But you can imagine, compared to air traffic, though, where we're all compressed into essentially 0 to 40,000 feet, what I'm talking about here is if the lowest Earth orbit is around about 100 kilometers or so, it's probably about 200 kilometers, but you're going all the way out to 36,000. So there's actually quite a lot of room out there. As you said, the place is vast, but we're going out beyond that as well. You know, so did you see the James Webb telescope, the successor to the Hubble? Absolutely amazing. If you get a chance to look at the miracles that have gone on to get that thing up and running, it's gone to a thing called the Lagrange point 2, which is just a point where the sort of gravity of the moon and the Earth cancel each other out a little bit. That's 1.2 million miles away. The Chinese have got a rover on the moon at the moment, and people will be mining on the moon before you know it. So, you know, corridors going out to the moon and back. And as JB mentioned, you know, that sort of storage in space, there's a lot of people looking at being able to dock, get their supplies up, do whatever, and then onto the moon, back to the moon, back to the same thing, unload, and then come back to Earth. So, I mean, it's not science. It is not science fiction anymore, but it's amazing how, if you look back over the last 80 years worth, 90, 100 years worth of science fiction, how much stuff is actually happening that was in there.
What do they do? So, you know, I guess, I mean, I don't know whether it's tactical. You know, why Russia has fired that missile up to destroy that satellite and the debris that that's then created. But given that, you know, there must be, you know, in the same way your car runs out of steam and becomes defunct. And I'm sure everyone's heard, you know, space junk floating around out there. At what point does that then become You know, how many defunct satellites are there now out there that are just floating around the Earth? And is there, you know, is it going to be the oceans? I don't want to get too deep, but, you know, the ocean of the future with plastic bottles and us, you know, going with plastic in the oceans, killing everything. You know, we're surrounded by defunct satellites. And how do we now get rid of them?
Well, it's a really interesting question, a really good analogy as well. And an awful lot of companies right now are looking at debris removal because you pay for that service and people are going to earn a lot of money doing it if they can come up with it. So there's some really interesting technology around. And there's a UK company actually, initially headquartered in Japan, but Astroscale. And they're currently at the moment demonstrating that they can essentially formate and then dock on a bit of space junk and then deorbit it. So the good thing about low Earth orbit is that stuff decays back towards the Earth and then will burn up at some particular point. When you get to medium Earth orbit around 20,000 kilometers, and when you get to geostationary orbit 36,000 kilometers, it's less so. So you have to go and grab stuff and take it out. In that geostationary orbit, there's actually a graveyard slot beyond that where it's a legal requirement for those satellites with the last bit of fuel that they have to increase their orbit altitude to get into the graveyard slot so they're out of the way of that particular one. And I'm sure you'll see in the future that there will be, you know, little Wally type things, you know, up there grabbing spacecraft and bringing them back down so they burn up in the atmosphere. The good thing is that most of the stuff up there, when it does re-enter, burns up. So,
how high up is the space station?
That's around 500 kilometers, the International Space Station. And you might have heard there was some really good stuff on Twitter, actually, of the day after or the morning of after it happened, the Russian missile test. The NASA transmission up to the space station, which did have a couple of cosmonauts on it as well, having to get into their escape pods, essentially, because they thought the debris field was going to come near them. They didn't, and those pods are more heavily armoured, if you like, than the actual space station itself.
Wow! Yeah.
The pinnacle. Hey, I'm going to. I think, well, certainly for Jim that wanted to know about Godders, and to Matt Key. Hopefully, that's answered your question about Godders, but it's time for Parkinson now. So Dil Patel, who I think actually, with the amount of questions that he sent, is one of our two avid listeners.
One of the two listeners.
He's one of the two. Yeah. Question for Parky. Here we go. What was it like going from flying a fourth gen two seat? It's a bit derogatory. He says it's a fighter, maybe, to the single-seat F-16. So going from an F-3, fourth-gen, two-seat sort of interceptor, wasn't it, Parky? To your single-seat, full-up F-16 fighter. And were there any times when you thought, I wish I had a nav or a Wizzo here with me right now?
Great question. Bizarrely, the Tornado F3 that I was flying would have been newer than the Dutch F16s, which were kind of like, I guess, 1982, and I think our F3s were sort of 86 onwards, which is amazing. I mean, the F16 was just, as Goddard will say, just so advanced, and just all boys bang on about their exchanges. Obviously, you didn't do one dunk, but the and love the aircraft that they flew. And you know, we've heard about the boys on the Mirage exchange and F18 and F all sorts of great jobs, but I absolutely would argue vehemently that the F-16 was just the most unbelievable jet. And it was awesome going from the F-3 was, you know, it was an interceptor and it did certain things well. And, you know, at the end of it, when it had AMRAAM and data link, what's that?
Running away, running away. Sitting a long way behind the line.
Yeah, it was, you know, and it was obviously air defence only. The F-16 squadron I flew with was half air defence, half MUD. So, you know, it was just completely swing roll. We did everything, and it was single seat. And the actual jet itself was just worlds apart from an F3. The boys that have flown Tornado, you had a trip, haven't you, Goddess, in a GR4, I guess. But the controls are spongy, might be a derogatory way, but they are not super light, and they are not, you have to put fairly big inputs in, really, to it's only doing the F3 display. Whereas the F-16 is extraordinary. You know, it is just side stick, and you move the thing millimetres and you'll pull 9G. So, you know, jumping into the F-16, I will remember, you know, just you know, the first trip, the first solos, you do some reeky climbs. Just the performance of the thing, it was amazing. I did it over Bosnia sort of operationally, and it was great. The cockpit was so well designed that genuinely, you know, I was sold on the single seat way. It was great. You definitely were busy, you know, if you were down low level, you know, it was out in Goose Bay, you were down at 100 foot flying. And, you know, if you're in the muddy package, you would be looking at your radar and flying at 100 feet. You were definitely up there, you know, with your workload, and it was all about your comfort level and maybe easing it up at times. But really interesting, really just a fabulous jet to have flown. The weird thing for me was I went F3, F16, then I went back to the F3. And that was that was almost an equal shock, because, you know, you just get muscle memory on how agile the F16 was. And as I mentioned, you know, jumping back into the F3, just the controls felt like, you know, slush until you get used to them. But then after a while, you know, you do get used to them. And then I, you know, displayed the F3, and I loved displaying the F3. It was brilliant. At certain things the F3 did, you know, an F16 at 500 knots, you know, you knew you were, it was, you know, noisy, rattly, and it, you know, you felt you were going fast, whereas the Tornado was ridiculous. At 600, it was super quiet and very slippery. So there were certain bits that it did particularly well, but the Viper was just brilliant. And I guess, God, as you were, you know, you had the same from the Harrier to the F16 in so many ways, must have been just worlds apart.
Yeah, it definitely was. The interesting thing you talk about there was the Wizzo bit, because it was only so the only time I flew in the front of the GR4 was in the simulator, but having an experienced Wizzo in the back made up for the fact that I didn't know anything about the aeroplane. And I just found it so much easier, you know, with an experienced individual in the back. Clearly I have no idea what that must have been like on an air defense type fighter, but I guess if you got the wrong person or you two didn't sort of come together as a team, it would have been a hindrance. But having only flown on my own, but I do remember on the F-16, and they said that I don't know whether you did on your first episode on your first flight, but was that sort of slight overcorrection as you come down on finals, where, you know, it's to do with the side stick, and you soon get used to it, but, you know, you're like, oh, I'm never going to be able to fly this flipping thing. Oh, funny enough, I can fly it, and it's really easy. And you're right, I love that aeroplane. Into they had that's why it's still flying today. They had absolutely everything correct on it. But, you know, you'll remember this, Parky. We had a ton of different people from a ton of different aeroplanes come over to Typhoon, so from two seat into single seat, and some people struggled a little bit, you know, because they were used to having a Navra Wizzo in the back, and some people just, you know, picked it up and went with it straight away. So kind of horses for courses, but I think both of us have definitely been on single seat missions where we're utterly maxed out, although you've probably been on a F3 mission where you're utterly maxed out as well.
Yeah, and then, you know, as you night, when it's getting very busy and you're doing stuff, to have a guy, you know, essentially operating the radar was great. And you know, when the two seat crew worked well, it was definitely up there. But, you know, and so much was to do with how well the, you know, cockpit was designed. But despite everything, you know, there will be times, there's no way any Typhoon mate will ever say he's not been maxed whilst flying that thing. You know, it can happen, and that's often the skill set, is just to fly the thing and
prioritizing
the spare capacity you've got, then do whatever else needs to be done.
We've got time for one more, Tom.
Actually we have got time for one more, and one more will be from me, because I've got a little bit of a quiz question for you all, and if you get it quickly, then we might have one more after that.
Go on, hit us with a quiz.
So I was reading an article, as I'm apt to do, the other day. And I found out a fascinating fact. I was thinking, I wonder if the boys know this, because it seems rather obscure. Does anyone know what aircraft was the last RAF aircraft to actually score an air-to-air kill with an RAF pilot inside it? And for extra points, can you give me the date and what it shot down?
Well, there was the Phantom that shot down the Jaguar.
There was, but that is not... That doesn't count, because that was an accident. But that was okay. Over Germany, was it not?
Yeah, that was.
So what? So just so where is it? Where's it got to be? Did you say there had to be a location?
No. It's just the last RAF aircraft flown by an RAF pilot to shoot down an enemy combatant.
Enemy combatant. All right, because there was one recently with a Typhoon, but
the boys in the Falklands didn't get any. The Sea Harriers got the kills. Were there any?
Yeah, no.
Who's the one who got four kills?
Sharky Ward?
Virgin.
No. Yeah, but that's in a Sea Harrier, so that doesn't count, is it?
Yep, that's Fleet Air Arm.
Fleet Air Arm. That's true. I think someone in a GR3 did shoot someone down in the Falklands.
Did they?
How about F-86 in Korea?
I think it's got to be after that.
I think it could be the Falklands.
Enemy combatant. I
mean,
JB.
Right. Are we warm, JB?
You're not. The Falklands is not warm. The warmest is Goddard's, actually.
Ooh, hang on. No, that was Navy, wasn't it? Because there was a Sea Fury kill in Korea?
I imagine there must have been a few kills in Korea. The meteors. Did we have sabres then?
We flew sabres as well.
What about hunters as well? Did hunters get anything?
Oh, Hunter. There's one.
Mm.
Would there have been any air-to-air kills in Oman?
Aden.
Interesting. Well, there was a rumoured kill, but this isn't it. There's a rumoured kill. A javelin shot down an Indonesian transport aircraft, apparently, but that was never confirmed. So that would be one.
Never heard that.
Yeah, Aden is not it. Do you want me to give you the type of aircraft that it was?
Yeah, go on.
Spitfire. Now, what was the year?
No way. Well, didn't Spitfire go out of service in... It was the 50s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Unless it was an RAF pilot on exchange somewhere, like India or something like that.
Nope. It was not on exchange. It was an RAF aircraft in an RAF squadron, and he's an RAF pilot.
Wow. In the 50s.
But it was clearly post-World War II.
Yes, it was.
When was that thing?
Our listeners now will be shouting. They'll be shouting at the...
go on, JB, put us out of the misery.
It was 1948. It was a Spitfire that shot down an Egyptian. Would you like to care?
Yes.
Go on.
No,
it was an Egyptian Spitfire. It's one of the few engagements where the aircraft had shot down another aircraft of the same type or even the same manufacturer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is
a good stat. I like that one. It's a good pub quiz.
Isn't it? So I was thinking about this. I thought, that can't be right, because there are loads of kills from loads of RAF types, but not from RAF pilots. And also RAF pilots who've been flying elsewhere. So, like, the Nats had loads of kills in, I think, Indian Air Force service over MiGs in Pakistani Air Force. I think the Hunts had a few kills, but not for us.
So why was the RAF fighting the Egyptians?
I believe, and I could have this wrong,
so we were fighting for the Israelis, were we, in support?
Well, so that was the creation, wasn't it, 48, that Israel... started existing.
Yes. So I think they were flying out of Palestine at that point.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, correct.
So not politically sensitive at all. But what a great little stat.
Amazing.
Blimey. Right.
That is good. On that bombshell.
Yeah. Have we got time for one more? Or?
We're 1 hour 11 in, and I've got to head out a load of snivels. So no, that's the answer. No, we don't.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, in case anyone's listening, we tried our hardest to go back to our roots of poor quality communications.
Yes.
A minor faff on here, but you know that makes you love us more.
Exactly. Hey, well, let's try to get one more in before the RAF play some serious inter-services rugby so we can have a little bit more RAF rugby chat, because I enjoyed that, despite what everyone else felt about it.
But another podcast, time, you mean?
Yeah, because we've got our inter-services games in March, and I think it'd be brilliant. You know, we've got a good chance on the women's side, and I think it'll be interesting with the men's whole new squad, but yeah, we can talk about it next time.
Exactly. Well, who knows? We could even do a podcast there. Goddard, tell us where we can find and contact the Pilot Episodes pod, please.
Pilot Episodes. Many of you will notice that I'm on a Twitter holiday at the moment. Essentially a social media holiday. It's so refreshing. But Pilot Episode Pod, and all of you have got your own Twitter handles, except Parky, who has Lego Parky, at Lego Parky. I still don't know who at Lego Parky actually is.
Disappeared, it's a shame.
Oh, they're not on there anymore.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
It is mentioned on those questions, actually, Godders, that I'm just trying to scroll through to see where it is. It's something, hang on, stand by. Why have you banned at Godders Twit from Twitter? Has he been stationed at RAF Luton?
RAF Luton, the famous RAF Luton.
That's from at Andy B UK.
Hey, just before we go,
so very quickly, yeah. But, well, I'll tell you the reason, shall I?
Yes,
it's quite funny.
Have you been trolled?
Yeah. So when I got the Space Command job, I in my own Twitter manner tweeted, delighted. I retweeted it. Got delighted to get the job. An amazing opportunity. Have been watching Netflix Space Force for top tips. I thought, yeah, that's me. Tweeted it. No one said anything on Twitter. The next thing I know, Daily Mail Online has got like a multiple page online story about me with the big headline, new UK space commander announced, says he's watching Netflix for tips. And at that moment, I thought, you know, I like being me on Twitter. And if people are going to take some of my tweets literally, and I don't want to be that person who just puts out bland tweets, I'll just stop for a little bit.
Yes.
And so I stopped, and it's quite nice.
Must have been a slow news day, Godders.
Well, it must have been. But it's probably still there on the Daily Mail website. You can go and have a look.
I'm surprised they didn't pick it up when you tweeted to infinity and beyond after getting the job. But, you know, I guess they're selective, aren't they?
No, exactly. But it's a shame not to be on there, because I did enjoy it. I'll probably be on there again soon, one day. But, it's quite handy being anonymous at the moment.
Excellent. Right, gents. Well, it's been a pleasure as always. And we will catch up again, hopefully, March-ish, I would say.
You think March?
Yeah, let's go February.
Yeah, maybe February.
Well, it's February. So. Yeah, okay, yeah, fine. End of Feb. Fine.
I know we are in February, but maybe the end of. Let's
end
be
of
optimistic.
February.
Yes. Let's do it.
Excellent. All right, gents, have a lovely evening.
Hope you get over your cold, JP.
I will. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.